Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and you're listening to Words on Film on WBCALP Boston. I will be reviewing some of the newest movies out right now.
For this show, I have four movies to review for you. One of them is brand new. The other three are not technically films that were released in 2024, but they have been given a recent nationwide release, particularly in independent theaters. And I'm very excited to talk about these films, but I'll start with the one that is the newest and has been released in the most theaters, as I usually tend to do when I'm hosting the show. The first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Monkey Man. And contrary to the name of the film, it is not a superhero movie, although Monkey Man would probably be a superhero that not a lot of people would take seriously, because what kind of superpowers would a superhero like Monkey Man actually have? Jumping high, swinging through branches? I don't exactly know. But anyway, Monkey Man is not that kind of film. It's more like an action thriller than it is a superhero movie. And it is about an anonymous young man who doesn't have a name. In the credits, he's only known as Kid. And he's played by Dev Patel from Slumdog Millionaire and many other great films. And he unleashes a campaign of vengeance against the corrupt leaders who murdered his mother and continues to systemically victimize the poor and the powerless. So this is a vengeance movie. And not only does Dev Patel star in it, he also directed it and co-wrote it along with Paul Angunawela and John Colley. And those are the people who wrote the story and the screenplay. And this is Dev Patel's feature film directorial debut. He directed a couple of shorts before this, but this is his feature film directorial debut. And it shows a lot of promise, even though the story itself is not all that original. So we're introduced to this kid, who is only known as Kid, as he lives in a village with his mother, who used to tell him tales of Hanuman, who is an Indian god. He's a deity in Hinduism. And one day, there is a greedy spiritual guru by the name of Baba Shakti, who orders Rana Singh, who is a corrupt police chief of a city called Yatana, to burn down the village where Kid lives and to acquire the land. And eventually this leads to the deaths of Neela and Neela is the mother of Kid, and many other villagers. And eventually Kid grows up and he has scars on his hands that he doesn't reveal to anybody what the source of the scars are. And probably one of the smarter moves of this movie, you don't find out what the scars are until a little bit more than halfway through the film. And the scars on his hands take on a deeper meaning. But eventually Kid becomes an assassin and he takes down this corrupt police chief and these corrupt underworld figures in India. And all the while he does this, he gets hurt, but he manages to land on his feet. And there's also a couple of confidants in his quarter. There's one underground boxing promoter by the name of Tiger, who's played by one, probably the only non-Indian person in this film, Charlton Copley, who is a South African actor best known for movies like District 9, for example. And there's also his best friend, Alfonso, who's played by a mononymic actor by the name of Pito Bosch. And they have some good scenes. And as a matter of fact, Alfonso has a vehicle that he calls Nicki, and he names it after Nicki Minaj because it's slim in the front, but it's very packed in the back. And you could probably put that together. But yeah, that was probably one of the funnier parts of the film when he explains why he names the car Nicki. But in addition to that, there are also some great car chase scenes with Nicki, including some where you're pretty positive that Alfonso and Kid are not going to get away so easily. Well, they don't get away easily, but they do eventually get away, and that's not spoiling a lot. But very much like the John Wick series, you see this film and you're kind of wondering how Kid can get away with as many obstacles as he does by getting hit in the head, stabbed, shot as much as he does. But it's pretty amazing because ultimately he does. Unlike John Wick, however, there's not a lot of dimension to the character of Kid, which is too bad because Dev Patel have played a lot of not only popular characters, but also very multi-layered characters. But here, he just has his mother die early in his life, and then he eventually grows up to be an assassin, and he takes down these assassins who killed his mother. And that's pretty much the character development of him. He doesn't so much get developed as a character, it's just only his fighting skills do. Now, that does lead for a lot of well-choreographed fights in this film, not to mention some excellent cinematography that sometimes sort of in the point of view of the character of Kid, where if Kid gets knocked down, the camera gets knocked down as well, and it leads to some very impressive, albeit dizzying, special effects. My gripe with this movie, though, is that the character of Kid, in spite of not having a name, isn't really developed very well as a character. He's just on a vengeance plan. And we've seen so many other films like this. And it's very surprising that Dev Patel wrote the screenplay, or should I say co-wrote the screenplay, but didn't give his own character a ton of dimension. And also, he has a confidant in that character of Tiger, who's played by Charlton Copley, but Tiger doesn't seem to do very much else except for introduce underground boxing matches. So he doesn't have very much more dimension than the Let's Get Ready to Rumble guy making a cameo in the various films that he does. And that's very disappointing because, like Dev Patel, Charlton Copley has also made a name for himself playing multi-layered and multi-dimensional characters. So, Monkey Man is a good action flick. I would put it various levels above action flicks like Silent Night, which was a film that came out last year that was directed by John Woo. It didn't have anybody famous in it, but it also had no character development in the film whatsoever. So it led to what was a pretty boring ride, other than some marginally impressive cinematography and choreography with the fighting. Monkey Man has a little bit more than this, but with Dev Patel and Charlton Copley alone acting in this film, not to mention Dev Patel as the director and as the co-writer, there should have been a lot more dimension to these characters, which is why I give Monkey Man my rating of a checkout. I do think it's elevated by its very impressive cinematography, its great atmosphere, its great set design, not to mention the excellent cinematography that shows a lot of these very impressive fight scenes taking place. But the reason that John Wick has lasted four movies like it has, with a possible fifth one and a spinoff coming out a little bit later, is because there was a lot more to the character of John Wick besides his car, his dog, and his fight scenes. And Keanu Reeves brought a lot of John Wick out there, which is why, part of the big reason why, people kept coming back again and again to see John Wick, including myself. I don't see that kind of lasting legacy with the movie Monkey Man, but given that Dev Patel directed this film and starred in it and included as much assets in it as he ultimately did, I think his next directorial effort, regardless of whether he acts in it or not, will probably be more impressive. So Monkey Man is a good start, but it's not quite there in terms of classics. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Butterfly in the Sky. This is a documentary all about the long-running PBS kids show, Reading Rainbow. In fact, Butterfly in the Sky, if you've ever seen an episode of Reading Rainbow or watched a YouTube video with the theme song, once I say Butterfly in the Sky, you could probably either get the song stuck in your head or sing the rest of the song for the rest of the day. And I have very fond memories as a kid of watching Reading Rainbow. I actually watched it when I was in preschool and kindergarten, and maybe a little bit in the first and second grade, but it was a show that was made for first and second graders, i.e. kids who are most likely to be learning to read. But I enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed shows like Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Today's Special, and Zubily Zoo back when I was a kid and I didn't have cable. As a matter of fact, when I remember being in college, being at lunch with some friends, and I told them that I didn't have cable until I was 12. And my family and I only had access on TV to four TV stations: ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS. And I remember these kids who went to college with me looking at me as if I had just told them, you know, it wasn't so bad when my dad beat me with a belt. It's when he took out the broken bottle that it was a really bad day. But, yeah, I didn't feel deprived because I didn't have cable when I was a kid. Sure, there were fewer selections, but there were other things to do as a kid besides watch TV. And that's a public service announcement from Words on Film. You're welcome. But anyway, Butterfly in the Sky tells the story about the inception and the growing popularity, and probably the constant popularity, of the show Reading Rainbow from when it premiered on PBS in 1983 to when they concluded the series in 2006, but still aired reruns throughout the next decade. And of course, this film would probably not be complete without the input of LeVar Burton, who hosted the show throughout its entire run. And even when he had high-profile gigs like being in movies, TV shows, and having a regular role on the syndicated show Star Trek: The Next Generation, he continued to host the show very enthusiastically. And this documentary, by the way, is directed by two men, Bradford Thomason and Brett Whitcomb. And both of them had previously joint directed a few short documentaries, but also one film called Jasper Maul, which I haven't seen. That one came out in 2020. It's probably one of the many films that I missed because I only had access to Netflix during the pandemic. But these directors not only interview LeVar Burton, but they also interview the creators of Butterfly in the Sky, the husband and wife duo who had the idea to bring about a show that doesn't teach kids to read, but it does let kids know about how much access they have to the library, how fundamental reading is, and also some excellent selections of kids' books that are out there. And once publishers, particularly children's book publishers, found out how influential how influential Reading Rainbow was to kids, and how having that sticker that was a Reading Rainbow book on the cover could be in terms of sales and also library rentals, they started to submit books to the showrunners by the box load. And it's pretty fascinating, some of the statistics that Reading Rainbow had throughout the 80s and 90s, not in terms of viewers, but in terms of book sales alone. According to this documentary, and according to the people who were involved in Reading Rainbow, sales of children's books went up 800% after this show premiered and became popular. And I totally believe that, because I remember when I was a kid, I loved to read, and I loved going to the library and to the bookstore with my parents. And whenever I saw a book that had that sticker that said a Reading Rainbow book, I remember I either immediately wanted to read it, or I remember that book being promoted and or read on that show. And I wanted to read it for myself, largely. And it was a wise idea to get LeVar Burton into this documentary to be interviewed. And I remember watching LeVar Burton when I was a kid, and I thought he made a great host. What I probably didn't have in mind when I was watching him was the idea of a black man hosting a show. Or at least I didn't have an appreciation for that, you know? I thought he was a great host, but I didn't take into account his race when I was watching the show. But there are some young, or some kids who grew up who either grew up watching the show or actually was one of the kids on the show who were kids of color, who expressed their appreciation for seeing someone who looked like them on this show, not talking down to kids, but talking with kids vicariously through the TV lens. And it's not something with which I can empathize, but it's certainly something I can sympathize and appreciate, how much of a big deal this was to kids of color as opposed to anybody else. But I also really liked hearing some of the kids here, like some child actors like Lisa Reyes and Kenny Blank, who were on the show, who were there promoting books, and also their unique experience in being on the show. There is a lot to love about Butterfly in the Sky, and I love this documentary not only for nostalgic purposes because I grew up watching the show, but also because it really gave me more of an appreciation for just about everything else that was in the show. And they start with the inception, how they got the idea for the show, why they chose LeVar Burton, of all people, to host the show. And also, there was a part of the documentary where they interview the music director for the show, and they actually show his mental process behind writing the iconic theme for the TV show. It's a lot of fascinating stuff. And Butterfly in the Sky definitely is a documentary that I can compare favorably to Won't You Be My Neighbor, which was a documentary that came out in 2018, was surprisingly snubbed for an Oscar nomination for Best Documentary. But the Oscars tend to deviate away from documentaries that are popular. Not necessarily, but usually. But Butterfly in the Sky is an excellent documentary. I think it not only highlights one of PBS's most popular shows, and not just amongst kids, but it also highlights how it got kids to read without actually teaching them to read. And Butterfly in the Sky gets my rating of a knockout because as I was watching this film, not only was I nostalgic, but I also gained an appreciation for every facet of this show, how LeVar Burton traveled from place to place and didn't just promote reading, but also promoted being curious and going out there and seeing a world and cultures that are unlike your own. Which is something that Mr. Rogers did as well, what Fred Rogers did on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. But LeVar Burton did that for slightly older children. But just about every kid who watched the show was certainly appreciative of the expanded worldview using the TV as an educational tool. And I'm even more appreciative as I see this excellent documentary, which I think you should see as well. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Hundreds of Beavers. This is a film that represents the feature film directorial debut of Mike Cheslick. It is a black and white film that is mostly silent. It has almost no dialogue and is one of the most unique, original, and hilarious films that I have seen in a long time. Mike Cheslick is a native of Wisconsin, and he has previously directed three other shorts, but Hundreds of Beavers is a film that will probably put him on the map and have the same kind of nostalgic and maybe even subversive appreciation that Mel Brooks's silent movie has as well. It has so much energy and so much creativity on a budget of reportedly $150,000, but it is amazing what they could do in this movie with just $150,000, which is minuscule by Hollywood standards. It's probably more expensive compared to the movie Paranormal Activity, which was made on a budget of $15,000, but made $195 million at the worldwide box office, making it one of the most profitable, if not the most profitable films ever made. So it goes to show you that it's not the budget of the film that necessarily counts. It's the spirit behind it and the creativity. And Hundreds of Beavers is a film that takes place in the 19th century, and it is about a drunken Applejack salesman who loses everything in a fire and must go from zero to hero and become North America's greatest fur trapper by defeating, as the title of the film suggests, hundreds of beavers. And the cider maker in this film is a man by the name of Jean Kayak, who's played by an actor by the name of Ryland Brixen Cole Twos, who reminds me in this film of such silent film actors as Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd, and I'm sure amongst other silent film actors like Fatty Arbuckle, for example, although he's in very good shape, so the comparison to between him and Fatty Arbuckle is not quite accurate, but in that sense, he has an innate sense of comic timing, especially slapstick, which I've kind of felt has been sort of a lost art, but I have seen films here and there from time to time that employ really good slapstick. There are other films with bigger budgets that don't quite have the sort of same slapstick timing that you would see in movies by the Three Stooges and the Marx Brothers, but this movie certainly measures up to a lot of those other films of the golden age of slapstick, and in an excellent way. And the beavers, as well as basically all woodland creatures in this movie, are obviously not real animals, nor are they CGI. They are people who are in mascot costumes. And that's very obvious when you actually see the film. But it doesn't take away from how creative the film was. As a matter of fact, I think all the slapstick that takes place in this movie made me laugh out loud throughout this film. And there was even a lot of creativity involving the beavers. The beavers actually don't say a word. They're not anthropomorphic in the sense that they talk. They do walk on two hind legs like human beings do, as you might expect from people who are in mascot costumes, but they still have a lot of ingenuity. And one of the best scenes in this film is the climax, where this Jean Kayak goes to the beaver's habitat, which is ultimately a woodmill. And the way he navigates out of this woodmill and also evades the detection of these beavers who could potentially kill him, maybe with a saw blade, is probably one of the most inspired parts of this film. And Hundreds of Beavers is a film that just was released in the theaters nationwide a couple of weeks ago. It premiered at Austin, Texas's Fan Fest on September 29th, 2022. So technically, it's not a 2024 film, but it's a film that I would probably be remiss for not considering for one of the best films of 2024. I'll probably consider it a 2024 film for that reason. I'm so glad that this got a nationwide release, and I hope as many people see it as possible. There's no rating associated with this movie, but it would probably be rated G. There's probably a lot of cartoon violence that reminded me not only of Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd films, but also of Looney Tunes cartoons, particularly those with Elmer Fudd. But I think this film is appropriate for all ages, and all ages are probably going to find this film hilarious. It is violent, but not violent in the sense of bloodshed or the kind of violence that I think kids would be, well, parents wouldn't want their kids to see. So Hundreds of Beavers gets my rating of a very enthusiastic knockout. This movie doesn't have color, it has sound effects, but not a lot of spoken dialogue, and a lot of the spoken dialogue is shown in title cards, like they are in silent films of that previous era. It doesn't need a lot of those expensive things. It's $150,000, and it's money that was very well spent in just about every aspect. The movie could have had some CGI in it to create these animals, but the chances are it might not have been as funny as the people in mascot costumes that we ultimately see here. Hundreds of Beavers is a very unique and original film that's a throwback in a lot of ways, but it's also very original, especially when a lot of people are saying that Hollywood is running out of original ideas. This is proof that movie makers, not necessarily people in Hollywood with the big budgets, do have original ideas. It's just a matter of getting that distribution out. And I'm so glad they did with Hundreds of Beavers. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Problemista. This is a film that stars, is written by, and is directed by Julio Torres, who is a native of El Salvador, who immigrated to the United States and became a comedy writer. He has written for shows like Saturday Night Live, and this is his directorial debut. He's been in a couple of movies up to this point as well, including films like Together Together and Nimona, which I haven't seen. So Problemista is my introduction to him, and what an introduction. Here, Julio Torres plays somebody who is probably based on Julio Torres himself, although his name is Alejandro. Like Julio Torres, Alejandro immigrated to New York City from El Salvador, and maybe a little bit unlike Julio Torres, Alejandro is an aspiring toy designer who is struggling to bring his unusual ideas to life in New York. And as time runs out on his work visa, he gets a job assisting an erratic art world outcast, and that becomes his only hope to stay in the country. And Alejandro here works for the eccentric artist by the name of Elizabeth, who is played here by a woman who is no stranger to playing eccentric characters, Tilda Swinton. And Elizabeth is married to Bobby, who's played by RZA, the actor and also the rapper who's best known for being one of the 9 members of the Wu-Tang Clan. And in this movie, Bobby is cryogenically frozen because he has terminal cancer, and he thinks that by being cryogenically frozen and being unthawed and awoken however many 100 years in the future, there will be a cure for his terminal cancer by the time he is regained in consciousness. And Alejandro is introduced to Elizabeth when he works at a cryogenics lab, and he is responsible for looking over the frozen body of Bobby. But then something happens where Alejandro ultimately gets fired from the cryogenics lab, and he has to find another job and have somebody sign his work visa, or else he will be deported back to El Salvador. And he is aspiring to work for Hasbro, and he has some creative ideas for some of their already established toy lines like Barbie and Cabbage Patch Kids. And he doesn't exactly want to work with Elizabeth because she's erratic and very hard to work with, but when he's facing deportation, he doesn't really have a choice. But eventually, as these kinds of movies go, the two people, one is erratic and very hard to please, and the other one is desperate to have a job, particularly in New York City, which is a city that is harder and harder in which to live because of gentrification and rising prices of everything from housing to food. So Alejandro has a very familiar story, particularly to immigrants, but even people who were born in the United States but not in big cities like New York, Chicago, or San Francisco would definitely relate to the impact that Alejandro's character is facing. And the scenes between him and Tilda Swinton are excellent, especially where Alejandro is trying to kind of find himself in addition to find employment. And he's also trying to get these sort of obscure and surreal paintings that Elizabeth's husband, Bobby, created, sold so that Elizabeth can also stay on her feet and afford the lifestyle that to which she has been particularly accustomed. And another thing that makes this movie particularly interesting is that Isabella Rossellini is the narrator of this film. And I don't think the film exactly needed a narrator, but Isabella Rossellini has a great narration voice, and she certainly adds some context to the struggles that Alejandro is facing, and there are many. And also, there are some other big names in this film, just a few big names here and there, like Greta Lee, who is the woman who is in the Academy Award-nominated film, which was one of my top 10 favorite films of the year, Past Lives. She surprisingly plays a small part, but a lot of people are talking about how she was snubbed for Best Actress, so there could be bigger parts for her in the future. She surprisingly plays a very small role, but one of the things that makes this film excellent is some of the surreal humor in it. For example, there are times in this film where Alejandro's dreams sort of cross into reality. For example, there's one scene where he is desperately looking for a job and he goes to a site where a lot of desperate job workers or job seekers look, which is Craigslist. And in this film, Craigslist is personified by an actor by the name of Larry Owens. And it feels like Alejandro is sort of negotiating with the devil when he's speaking to Craigslist, because Craigslist is personified as very obese, very smug, and also not giving the seekers the answers that they want to have, which is very, very reminiscent of Craigslist and has been ever since its inception in the mid-aughts. There's another great scene where Alejandro finds out that he is significantly over-withdrawn from his bank account through Bank of America, and he calls the bank representative to see where his money went. And he finds that he was over-withdrawn several times, and every time he paid for something but didn't have the money in his bank account for that thing for which he bought, the bank charged him $35 for every overdraft. And man, I can relate to that because that happened to me so many times. Like buying an $8 sandwich would ultimately be buying a sandwich for $43. That is so frustrating. And I hate it when banks do that. But big banks, particularly the Bank of America, does that quite a bit. But the way this scene is played out is not just Alejandro speaking over the phone. It also shows him in kind of a dark cave where he's dressed like a knight and he's being crushed by rocks while he's speaking to the bank representative who has who's brandishing a gun and is contemplating whether or not she should proverbially shoot Alejandro for his overdraft fees. There's a lot in here that's surreal, but all of it is very relatable, especially when you've come out of college and your dreams are slipping through your fingers, and you really not only want to make a mark in the world, but you also want to survive. And it's hard for an American like me to move to a new city and try to do all that. I can imagine the problem for somebody who has immigrated to this country and speaks the native language as a second language would really be struggling here. So Julio Torres inserted a lot of himself into this film, but all of it is absolutely welcome. And the film is perfectly cast, as I said, with Julio Torres doing a great job playing a character who is essentially himself. he works very well off of Tilda Swinton and her eccentricities, and you're rooting for him every step of the way. But this film is so unique and reminds me very much stylistically of Michel Gondry in a sense. And if Michel Gondry had directed this film, I'm sure he would have done a great job too. But Julio Torres doesn't probably have that connection, or at least didn't when he was making this film, to get Michel Gondry. It would have helped, but he did an excellent job directing this film himself. And it says a lot when somebody does a great job directing a film themselves and stars in the film as well. Like, they can direct themselves as well as they direct everyone else. And that can't be said for a bunch of actors, even well-established actors like Ben Affleck, who has had mixed results directing himself. He's directed some excellent films like Gone Baby Gone and Argo, but when it's come to other films in which he's acted, like The Town, where he's also directed himself, his acting has fallen a bit short. But I can't say the same for Julio Torres, and that is a testament to how excellent a director, and for that matter, an actor he is in this film. Which is why I give Problemista my rating of a knockout. I think it is a quirky and very cathartic independent film that works on just about every level. And it also has a universal theme about a guy who is unsure of himself, but becomes more sure of himself as he is trying to survive any which way he can. And we're with him every step of the way, rooting him on. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. And now that I've reviewed all the movies that I have to review for you for this show, it's now time for me to get into my final segment, which is What's Coming Up Next. This is a spoken word preview of movies that are subject to being released in theaters for the week of April 8th through April 12th, 2024. And normally I also put in movies that are going to be premiering on streaming, but I don't usually have a ton of time to cover those. But if I have time at the end of the show, I'll definitely cover those. But there are a number of interesting films that are subject to being released in theaters for this next week. On April 10th, 2024, there's a film that is likely to be released in independent theaters, and it's a film that's called It's Only Life After All. It is a documentary about the Indigo Girls, who are known for stirring harmonies and socially conscious lyrics. They are the iconic folk rock duo who are the subject of this intimate and insightful documentary, which tracks their decades-long career. And the Indigo Girls have never been a group that has been commercially successful, but they've definitely had an underground following, and they also are still touring to this day, from what I can tell. I haven't been the biggest fan of the Indigo Girls. I don't hate them, but I don't especially care for their music. But I'm still not against seeing this documentary. I mean, after all, they have made music that does mean something to a lot of people out there, particularly when they first became a band in the 80s and definitely filled a void, particularly with the lack of lesbian musicians that were out there. So it's a film that I will see, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. On April 12th, 2024, there are a number of big films that are going to be coming out, and it is likely that there are going to be other films that will be pushed out of multiplexes to make room for these films that are coming out in theaters nationwide, presumably. In other words, it's subject to being released on April 12th. The biggest film that's going to be released in theaters on April 12th is a movie that's called Civil War. Is this about the Civil War that lasted from 1861 to 1865? No, it is not. It is a journey across a dystopian future America following a team of military embedded journalists as they race against time to reach Washington, D.C. before rebel factions descend upon the White House. And this film has been described as an action film. And the stars of the film include Nick Offerman, who plays the President of the United States. That's a good casting choice right there. Kirsten Dunst, Wagner Moura, Jefferson White, Nelson Lee, and Evan Lay, amongst other people. So this is about the future Civil War, which is why I think a better name for this film probably should have been Civil War II, because then that would immediately get people to presume that it's going to be a film that takes place in the future. It also could be a documentary about how Americans are politically divided today, but that's another story. The writer and director of this film is Alex Garland, and some of his previous directorial efforts have been some very surreal but also very appealing and unforgettable films. He hit the scene in 2015 with the film Ex Machina, which I thought was an excellent film, to which I could compare favorably to Stanley Kubrick. It puts Alicia Vikander on the map, and I think it's her best performance to date. As a matter of fact, she won an Academy Award in that same year, 2016, for the movie The Dutch Sister. And it's funny because I didn't think she was as good in that movie, but I thought she was excellent in Ex Machina, which is why I found it odd that she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for that film, but not for Ex Machina. It was a big mistake on the Oscars part, but I still haven't forgotten Ex Machina. It is an excellent film. He also directed Annihilation, starring Natalie Portman, and Men, starring Jesse Buckley and Rory Coltrane, which is a... Rory Kinnear. That was a mistake on my part. Men was a very, very, very strange film, and it was also snubbed for Oscars because, yeah, it was surreal, it was jarring, it was scary, but I think that it worked as a film. So Civil War is probably Alex Garland's most commercially accessible film, but judging from his previous repertoire, I don't think it's going to pull any punches, and I can't wait to see how the film ultimately is. So Civil War is a film that I will see, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie that's subject to being released in theaters on April 12th, 2024, is a movie that's called Arcadian. And this is a film starring Nicolas Cage as the father of twin teenage sons who, with his teen sons, fight to survive in a remote farmhouse at the end of the world. I don't know exactly what the end of the world actually means, but it's probably an apocalyptic film. Knowing that Nicolas Cage is in it, it's going to be a film where he is intense. But I'm very curious to see how this film fares, because Nicolas Cage, I think, is on his way to making a comeback. I mean, he's definitely churning out film after film, and that's largely because of his dire financial situation, having made bad investments in real estate, amongst other things. But Nicolas Cage, to his credit, is A, still a household name, B, in terms of the quality of his films, some have faltered, but when he's been good, he's been really good. And C, he always gives it his all. So I'm very interested to see Arcadian. I don't know if it's coming out in a theater near me, but if it is, I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie that is subject to being released in theaters on April 12th, 2024, is a movie that's called Sting. And Sting is a film that is a horror thriller. It's not about the British singer, whose real name is Gordon Sumner, although I think if they made a documentary about him, it would be fascinating, considering he's had a 50-plus year career in music, and I don't think he's ever released a boring record. But anyway, this film is about a 12-year-old by the name of Charlotte, who, after raising an unnervingly talented spider in secret, she must face the facts about her pet and fight for her family's survival when the once charming creature rapidly transforms into a giant flesh-eating monster. yeah, okay, this movie is definitely kitsch. And I'm actually more curious what kind of talent a spider would have. Would it know how to tap dance? Would it do math? Now, if this movie was about a tap dancing spider, I would totally be on board. But yeah, apparently this film is kind of similar to Arachnophobia, although the spiders in Arachnophobia did not turn into giant flesh-eating monsters. But Sting is still a film that I will see, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie that is subject to be released in theaters on April 12, 2024, is a movie that's called The Long Game. It's a film that stars Dennis Quaid and Jay Hernandez, and it looks to be a film that is in the genres of drama and history. So this is presumably based on a true story. And it's a film that takes place in 1955, and it's about five young Mexican-American caddies out of their love for the game of golf who were determined to learn how to play. So they created their own golf course in the middle of the South Texas desert. So presumably Dennis Quaid plays one of their mentors, either that or an antagonist in this film. And some of the other people who star in this film besides Dennis Quaid and Jay Hernandez include Jillian Vigman, Jaina Lee Ortiz, her name is probably pronounced Jaina Lee Ortiz, Brett Cullen, Oscar Nunez, and Cheech Marin. So a couple of familiar names there. The Long Game is a film that I might see, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie that is subject to be released in theaters on April 12, 2024 is a movie that's called Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. And if you think this is a remake of the 1991 film of the same name, then you are absolutely right. But it's a movie about a girl by the name of Tanya, who is played by Simone Joy Jones, who finds her summer plans canceled when her mom jets off for a last-minute retreat and the elderly babysitter who arrives at her door unexpectedly passes away. So, normally I'm against films that are remakes of either great films or classic films. But truthfully, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, the original 1991 film, is neither great nor a classic film. As a matter of fact, it seems to be one of those films where things would be a lot clearer, or the family who encounters this dead babysitter would be in a lot better hands if they just told the truth about what happened. Now, the babysitter in that movie died of natural causes. She wasn't murdered. If she was murdered, then the family would have very good reason to panic because they'd have to cover their names. But she died of natural causes, and they just make things really complicated in the movie. I hope that this movie is an improvement over the original Don't Tell Moms the Babysitter's Dead. It has certainly a diverse cast in it, including Jermaine Fowler, Simone Joy Jones, as I said, Iantha Richardson, Nicole Richie, one of the familiar names here, and also June Squibb is in this film as well. She's obviously not one of the more diverse cast members, but I'm kind of hoping she's not the same kind of babysitter that the babysitter in Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead was. And if you've seen the film, you pretty much know what I'm talking about. But this remake of Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead is a movie that I'm very eager to see. I hope to see it, and if I do, I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie that is subject to being released in theaters on April 12, 2024, but may be released in limited release, is a film that's called The Absence of Eden. And this film stars Zoe Saldana as an ICE agent who is struggling with the moral dilemmas of border security and an undocumented woman fighting to escape a ruthless cartel, cross paths, and work together to save the life of an innocent girl. So it definitely has a lot of timely themes in it, a lot of hot topics, including immigration, especially illegal immigration over the Mexican border, and also an ICE agent whose job it is to get rid of illegal migrants. But she also finds herself facing some consequences when she has to save someone. So it's very intriguing. In addition to Zoe Saldana, the movie stars Adria Ayorna, Garrett Hedlund, Tom Waits, and if a movie has Tom Waits in it, it can't be all bad. I don't think I've ever seen Tom Waits in a terrible film. And very much like Nicolas Cage, Tom Waits gives it all when he's in a movie. So anyway, that pretty much does it in terms of actors that I know and maybe you know, but I don't know if The Absence of Eden is going to be released in a theater near me. I kind of hope it is, because it definitely seems like one of those important films, or at least a film with a very important and hot topic. But if it does come out in a theater near me, I'll let you know what I think on a future show. And the next movie that is subject to being released in theaters on April 12th, 2024, is a movie that's called In Flames. This is a movie that does not have an all-star cast, which probably means that it might not be released in theaters nationwide. But it's about a mother and daughter who, after the death of the family patriarch, live a precarious existence that is ripped apart. And they must find strength in each other if they are to survive the malevolent forces that threaten to engulf them. This is not only a drama film, but it's also a horror film. The stars of the movie include Ramisha Nawal, Omar Javed, Bakhtawar Mazhar, and Muhammad Ali Hashmi. So this is obviously a foreign film, and it's a film that is likely to be released in theaters that are not as, that don't have as many mainstream choices in them, i.e. art house theaters, which I love. But In Flames is a movie that I may not see, but if I do, as always, I'll let you know what I think on a future show. That just about does it for this episode of Words on Film. Words on Film is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures, and I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke, reminding you that the views and opinions expressed on Words on Film about movies or other topics are solely those of your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. They do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of any employees or volunteers who are working at WBCA or the station as a whole. Until I watch a whole bunch of brand new movies, this is Dan Burke saying I'll see you at the movies.